This episode of Second Life is brought to you by the House of Chanel.
For Gabrielle Chanel, dance was always a natural fit, reflecting the freedom of movement she introduced to the fashion world. Dance was an opportunity, that of meeting the flamboyant producer of the Ballet Russe, Serge Diaghilev, becoming his friend, costume designer, and patron, of having her name associated with Cocteau, Picasso, and Stravinsky. For Chanel today, dance remains the very essence of culture and elegance. To discover more, visit inside.chanel.com.
Hi, everyone. I'm Hillary Kerr, and this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. Today, I am delighted to have a little time with Kim Malik, who has created a company that means a great deal to me personally. Her brand, Salt and Straw, is the most incredible ice cream company and one that I have personally been following since their food cart days back in Portland, Oregon in 2011. Yes, I am an ice cream nerd. Today, they're a much bigger business, which means nationwide shipping, a slew of stores, including 3 in Washington, 4 in Oregon, 15 in California, and their first East Coast shop is set to open in Miami early this year. They're known for really interesting flavor combinations like pear and blue cheese, as well as salted malted chocolate chip cookie dough, plus vegan flavors like peanut butter strawberry crumble. Each store is tailored to its location and incorporates local and seasonal ingredients to create even more rotating flavors, which I think is an amazing and very cool business model. Of course, since this is Second Life, you know that Kim didn't start out as the president and CEO of her own ice cream empire. Oh no! She actually started her career in the marketing world at companies like Adidas, Starbucks, and Red before becoming an entrepreneur. She's here to tell us all about her journey, and I am so delighted to have her. Now, on Second Life, it's Kim Malik. All right, Kim, are you ready?
I'm ready!
Okay, good. So we like to start at the beginning on this podcast. So what did you study in school, and what did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
Well, I started thinking about that at a pretty young age. I can remember when I was probably, fourth or fifth grade, reading Peggy Noonan's book. She was a speechwriter for Reagan.
Yes.
And I was convinced I was going to go into politics. My parents are really very conservative, and I ended up on the other end of the aisle. But what they gifted me with is just a real passion for politics. So that was an early passion of mine, and went on to study in school communications. And that was sort of the path I was on.
So tell me about your first post-college career move. What was that first job, and where did you think it would lead you?
So while I was working in college and doing all these internships, I got a job as a barista in 1989 with a little company called Starbucks Coffee.
I think I've heard of it.
I think there were 30 stores when I started, and Howard Schultz himself would come to our store meetings and talk to us about the company and what he hoped to achieve and what role we played. And, you know, we all felt very important and committed to the company. And so as I was then getting ready to graduate, I remember one of my customers at the time had offered me a job in real estate development. And I also applied for a job in marketing for Starbucks, which was still a very small company. It was like 1993. And I got the job at Starbucks. And so I ended up going in that direction.
So what was that first job like?
It was pretty cool to be part of just the really early days. You know, there weren't many of us sitting around the table figuring out, you know, we're in Oregon and Washington, and I think Chicago at the time were the three cities that Starbucks existed in. And so I was there as we were trying to figure out what new markets to open and how we would go about communicating what a latte was to people in Los Angeles, for example. I was part of that little crew. And no one knew, you know, what it was and if they're going to pay whatever it was at the time, $1.50 for a latte. So, you know, that was really the work that I got to do. I got to work on these new store openings. And just as a really young college graduate, you know, being included and being part of so much of that work and being at the table with those really talented visionaries was an incredible experience. And we worked so freaking hard. I can remember, like, we had to go in every Sunday night and prepare all the sales data for the leadership team on Monday. And it was just all-consuming and really fun.
I think that's one of the things that people should really take into consideration when they're first starting out. Like, it's wonderful to work for a very established company or a very established corporation, but when a company is up and coming, you often get to do a lot more at a more formative stage than maybe you would in a company that had been around for 40 years necessarily. And it sounds like that was your experience.
That's definitely true. I mean, there's all kinds of trade-offs for sure. No one had ever really heard of Starbucks coffee. I remember my mom and my dad thought I didn't get a very good job out of college. They were like saving my childhood room in case I needed to move home.
Wow.
So they definitely, like, it wasn't a prestigious thing necessarily, but, you know, folks in Seattle obviously knew what it was. And I just believed wholeheartedly in, you know, the vision that they had. And I've always chosen work that I thought would be really fulfilling. And that was definitely the case then.
Okay, so what did you do next? And how did you know that it was time to move on?
Gosh, well, I will tell you sort of a spoiler alert that I was a boomerang. So I left Starbucks and came back. So I was based in Portland for a little while with Starbucks and fell in love with someone and decided that I would move to Portland, Oregon. And I actually ended up working for a company called Garden Burger at the time. Mm-hmm. And it was a bunch of people who had come to Portland from Quaker Oats. And I had always heard, being in marketing, that you should work for a CPG firm. And, you know, we don't have many of them in the Pacific Northwest. So I felt it was a cool opportunity to get to work for these pros, these industry veterans, again, in a really growing company that was, you know, trying to create a brand new category in veggie burgers. Well, yeah. Before Beyond Meat and all the incredible brands that are out now.
Yeah, they were early.
Yeah, really early.
Okay, so you spent some time at Garden Burger, and then you were also on the marketing side of things at Yahoo and then Adidas. Can you tell me a little bit about what you were working on at this point in your career and the skills that you were honing?
Yeah, you know what I found myself attracted to over and over? You know, at Yahoo, I was working on this new platform and category called auctions, which was brand new to the world at the time. And then at Adidas, you know, we were really way, way far behind Nike and we were trying to kind of relaunch the brand. So I found myself in these positions where I was kind of bringing products to a new market and educating a new category of customers about a product. So I think that was something that I really fell into and enjoyed doing early on.
So one of the things I also think is interesting is that you would spend a year or two in each position and then you would sort of move on. Mm. I think it's important for people to understand when it's time to move on or why you should move on. So I'm curious if you could tell me a little bit about what would entice you to move after that period of time.
Yeah. I mean, I think there were a mixture of things. Sometimes it was life circumstances, mm-hmm. oftentimes love. Mm-hmm. And yeah. Sometimes it was, you know, for this next big career move. So, I mean, as I've done a lot of soul searching, especially over the past 10 years being with Salt and Straw, I found that I've always battled with this entrepreneur spirit. Mm-hmm. And I think that led to a little bit of a 2 or 3 year stint here or there, because that entrepreneurial, I'm launching this, I'm bringing it to market, would then move into a different phase, which was never as much fun to me.
Got it. So you like the launch, right?
I love the launch. I love the start. I love the beginning.
It's so crazy you love that part. You're like, yes, give me the difficulty. And once that stress and pressure is off, then I'm on to the next one.
I know. I must be like a glutton for pain. I don't know.
So then in 2002, you made your boomerang move back to Starbucks, where you stayed for nearly 5 years and left as the director of global innovation. First of all, what does that mean? And secondly, will you tell me a little bit about your time there, part two?
Yeah, that was a very, very different chapter in the company's history and for me. I held a couple of different global positions. I worked on tea, coffee, believe it or not, Frappuccino. In innovation, we were really looking at, you know, new categories. It was really very, very early in the days before those capsule coffee machines were being brought to market. So I was working on projects like that. And for me, it was such a cool opportunity to get to run a whole P&L from start to end, coming up with a product idea, working it through our entire system to, you know, R&D to bring it to life, purchasing to secure the materials, operations to train, marketing to bring it forth into the world, finance to, you know, demonstrate how it did. So it was sort of the perfect sort of part two to the training I needed to start my own business.
What were the biggest takeaways that you have from working at Starbucks, and how did it influence you when you decided to start your own thing?
Yeah. I mean, the number one takeaway I had from Starbucks I mentioned earlier in this conversation is that feeling I had when Howard Schultz was in our store meeting. He and the leadership team would really talk to us as if we were equals and invested so much time and money and training and emotional support into us understanding the brand and the vision and having what we needed to take forward this idea. And I was so moved by that. I still am, that I, as I started Salt and Straw, as I moved through my career, I always thought back to that moment where, you know, that person on the front line of your business should feel from you that they are the most important person in the company, because it's true, you know. And I think it set such a important foundation for what has made that company really successful. It's all about the people. And that idea that you can invest a little more than others think is logical in people, in your partnerships, in your community, in your product, and build that into your business plan and make that pay off and approach things differently than everybody else has done. And just know that, like, I'm going to stay true to this. This is what my vision is about, even though everybody thinks you're crazy. Those are some really important lessons I got to have, you know, just right out of the gates early in my career.
So before we get to your own company, let's talk about your time at Red, which was your next move as marketing director. So first things first, on the off chance that someone in the audience doesn't know about Red, it was founded by Bono and Bobby Shriver to harness the power of people, companies, and corporate profits to fight AIDS worldwide, and also does amazing work fighting tuberculosis and malaria and many other things. The company partners with iconic brands on products that then generate the revenue that powers the global fund to the tune of $650 million since the company was founded, which is crazy. So I'm curious, why did you want to join this team specifically, and what were your responsibilities as the marketing director?
Well, first of all, way back in the day when I was reading Peggy Noonan's book and wanting to go into politics, I never lost that love of, you know, making an impact on a social level or political level. That stuck with me throughout my career as a big passion. And so a gentleman named Don McKinnon founded Hear Music, and he sold his company to Starbucks. And so I got to know him a little bit while he was at Starbucks, and he left to go and work for Bono at Red. And so he was looking for someone to join him. And I applied for the job and was picked, which was amazing. And we were based in Seattle, but commuting to New York where the head office was. And he was tasked with starting up a new music service that would benefit Red. So it was a little bit different than, you know, Apple and Gap and Dell and all the different companies that would turn products Red. This was going to be the first product that was from Red, and it was a music service.
So what were the best things that you learned at this job, and what did you not like?
Well, I made, as you can imagine, the most incredible connections at this job because we were working with sort of like the presidents and CMOs at most of the top companies throughout the world, for sure throughout the United States. So it was pretty incredible to be at the table and be part of their marketing conversations, learn how they think about their brand, how they're structured, and just get to know them as people. So I'm pretty good at collecting relationships and connections, and find that those are probably my biggest asset throughout my career that I've been able to keep with me. And so that was a huge benefit from this position. Also, just that going back to my roots and the idea that businesses need to be at the table as a part of solving social challenges that we have in this world. So it can't just be governmental agencies in partnership with the government off fixing the world's problems while businesses are off doing their thing and making money. Like that's just not sustainable. And businesses have to be at the table as an equal partner. And I love that idea. And I saw it come to life there. And I've definitely taken that forth in my, you know, current work with my company now.
So what didn't you like?
What didn't I like? You know what? I think I came to understand what the term flying too close to the sun means.
Interesting.
Your work, you know, it can be very volatile to be sort of on the chopping block of the top personalities in the United States. It's, I guess that's what you would call true politics, you know, from a corporate perspective with everyone involved. So and I've come to use that term even now, like we'll get on someone's radar and they want to help us and talk to us. And I'll tell my team like, oh, be careful. This may come with strings attached.
Interesting. So obviously you'd had the itch to start something of your own for a while. You clearly have this entrepreneurial spirit. But at what point did you decide to finally like figure things out and make a business plan and start moving on your own gig?
Well, you know, I mentioned that I had lived in Portland in the early, kind of mid-90s with Starbucks. And anyone who spent much time in Portland, which, you know, Portland's been in the news a lot the past few months.
I love Portland.
Thank you. I love Portland too, but it's a really unique environment. And what I was struck by when I was here in the mid-90s was just this total sense of community and collaboration. I always say that it's like people bring, you know, they pick you up and lift you forward and call you one of their own really quickly. There aren't many big Fortune 500 companies here, so I think it creates a very innovative grassroots culture. And that whole spirit of the city, I could clearly see an ice cream shop being a good way to reflect it. Just a place where this kind of mentality where you're running into people and suddenly they're your best friends, you know, like that could happen at an ice cream shop. And so I started writing a business plan in the mid-90s. I started looking for real estate. And I got really super freaked out about that path and shelved the idea. You know, when I was in college, my father actually went bankrupt running his own company. And so just the idea of doing that seemed like a bad one to me. It was a very painful experience. So although I could see the vision really clearly and I wanted to do it, I just didn't have it in me to take that leap at the time. So fast forward to probably 2009, I was working for Red and they decided, you know what, Kim and Don, you can't live in Seattle anymore. You need to move to New York. And so we were looking for housing in New York and about to move there. And I came back to Portland for a birthday party, and I met a guy in a bar, which I always say doesn't usually end well, but this time it did. And we're still together, and we adopted three children and have had this nice life together. And instead of moving to New York, I moved to Portland. So here I was in Portland and, you know, looking for a new job because I didn't move to New York with the job I had. And I remember opening the New York Times one morning, and it was a Sunday, and the New York Times magazine fell out, and the front cover was Humphrey Slocum ice cream.
Yes, I remember that.
Oh, it was a beautiful cover. I still have it. I held it up to Mike and I said, someone else is doing my idea. I had this idea in 1996. I wrote the business plan and, you know, I'm literally like shaking my fists at the heavens. And he let me finish this rant and he said, well, I think you should do it. And, you know, it's like when someone kind of calls you on your dream and now you have to go do it. And I started work on it that afternoon, I think.
So, but Kim, we got to talk about something, which is you are not an ice cream maker, correct?
No, I'm not even a very good cook.
So how did you think you were going to pull this off?
I figured I would partner with a really great chef. I knew I would figure that out. And wouldn't you know it, I'm just totally out of left field. My cousin, who is much, much younger than me and had been studying business and living in China, he came home due to a death in the family and started cooking just to kind of soothe everyone's spirits. And figured out through that experience that he really should be a chef and not a businessman. And he decided to go to culinary school in Portland. And so he moved to Portland, moved into my basement, was starting culinary school, and really just was determined to make ice cream for Salt and Straw. And I quickly realized he is quite incredibly talented, and we started the company together.
So walk me through the early days. You tried to get funding, but since this was like recession era 2010, I'm assuming there wasn't a lot to be found. And I'm curious as to what sort of feedback you were getting to your business plan.
Oh, yes. 2011, I was so naive. I was meeting with banks and presenting them with my business plan. And it didn't occur to me that not only is it the recession, so they're not going to loan really anybody money, but they're especially not going to loan money to an ice cream shop in Portland. So I met with all these banks. In fact, I'm still in touch with a couple of the bankers who declined my loan. To this day, they gave me really good feedback to my business plan. So I had a great buttoned up business plan. They corrected some errors and challenged me on some things and in the end couldn't loan me the money. But I then sent it out to a few friends of friends who I've heard were investors. I didn't really know what investors were. And I got just the most horrifying feedback. You know, this one guy wrote all over it with a red pen and mailed it back to me with all the things that were wrong, including some typos. And I remember throwing it away as fast as I could so that the idea that this wasn't going to work wouldn't sink in. Mm-hmm. But I just couldn't come up with any money. So I can recall sitting in my home office looking through my files for something. And I just happened to see this file that said 401k. And I pulled it out and I said, ah, I do have some money. I've been in these big corporations all my career. I remember Phil Hummel told me to start putting money in my 401k when I was exactly 19 years old. And I had been doing that ever since. So I cashed that in and maxed out my credit cards and sold my house in 2011, which didn't get me much money. And
so hang on here. You cashed in your 401k, you maxed out your credit cards, and you sold your house to start your company. Were you having a heart attack when you were doing all of this? Or were you even considering the implications of it? What was running through your mind?
Yeah, I mean, I even had a garage sale. Like, I sold everything I could sell. No, because I had just had a really great career and I knew I could go get another job and make more money.
I love that confidence that you're like, whatever, I'm going to try this. And if it doesn't work, I'm going to get more money somewhere else from another job.
Yeah, work, that would be there. And I knew I could do it. But this, I don't know. I always tell entrepreneurs, like, this idea was stronger than me. I had no second thoughts once I started. It was going to happen.
Kim, I love this. Okay, so you wanted an ice cream shop where the community gathered, like a great neighborhood spot, and you wanted a place that really used and celebrated local produce and products, and you also needed to make phenomenal ice cream. So can you tell me a little bit about figuring out sort of the initial assortment and how that process worked?
Yeah, it was an interesting process because my cousin Tyler, as I mentioned, he was in culinary school. So he really didn't know how to make ice cream either. And one of my superpowers is to connect with people. And so as we started to think about different product ideas, I would reach out to different folks in the community. So when Tyler first started work, I said to him, well, Tyler, what about like a maple bacon flavor? And he said, you know, Denny's has that. And I don't think we should be like Denny's. And, you know, God bless him. This is how Tyler works. He came home a few days later and he said, I was just getting to know all the local microbreweries and this brown ale at Laurelhurst Brewing is kind of mapley. So what if we made a, you know, brown ale ice cream and we could figure out the bacon part? So we contacted the brewers, and no kidding, we didn't even have a company at the time, but they got Tyler in the back, and they're figuring out how to brew beer and cream and use all the same ingredients. They figured it out together. And then wow. Olympia Provisions, which is like one of the top charcuterie houses in the United States, they had us over, and we were picking out bacons and how to candy them and how they would freeze and getting it all straight. And I think through those early days of meeting with people to figure out how to turn their ingredients into ice cream, I mean, we were both so just curious and humble, and we didn't really know what we were doing. And so this collaborative nature really took shape as a central theme to the company. And it was obviously a forefront of why we wanted to start the company, but to have it be reflected so importantly through the products that we came up with, almost out of necessity, because we were learning how to make the ice cream in partnership with them, was like a happy accident and is probably one of the most important things that we hold up, you know, today as we grow.
So what were the original flavors? And did you have any sense of whether people would like them or not?
Yeah, I mean, we were making ice cream at this local, it's called the Food Innovation Center, which is a collaboration between Oregon State University and the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And they support companies that are going to use local agriculture products as a way to kind of, you know, build the farming industry. And so that was really a cool thing because we got access to all their food scientists and fancy equipment. And we tapped into their experts a lot when we were coming up with flavors. So we didn't do any kind of like taste testing or anything like that. But we had, you know, a good support group of folks helping us sort of refine what our flavors should be. Mm-hmm. We started off, I mean, we had, and we still have what I've been told is, you know, the best vanilla and a really lovely basic chocolate. And it's chocolate gooey brownie. It's not just plain chocolate. But then we also had flavors like pear with blue cheese, which we still do. We had a strawberry honey balsamic with black pepper, cinnamon snickerdoodle. The flavors, each one of those has a story behind it. So like blue cheese, Rogue Creamery is a famous blue cheese company here in Oregon. And so we worked with them on this pear and blue cheese. Oregon's famous for its pears. So sometimes people think, oh, salt and straw, the flavors are very peculiar. We don't do it to be weird ever. We do it because there's a story, a person, a company behind it. And that's where that was born from.
So what was like the big initial hit? And was there a flavor that you really loved, but didn't necessarily like set the world on fire?
Well, it was a funny story. I was convinced in my heart of hearts that no one would show up to our opening and we wouldn't make any money because I live in fear constantly. I still do. So we started as a food cart. We had this little cart. And on our opening day, I took the cart, was in the Oregon wine country catering a wedding so that at least, you know, we'd have a little income for the day. And my friends had come to town for the opening and they called me and said, Kim, you better get back right away. It's really busy. And I rushed back and it sure was really busy and they were all working behind the line. Thank goodness. They were so generous with their time. And right off the bat, you know, we have a sea salt ice cream with caramel ribbons. That was a huge hit. Our chocolate, our vanilla, kind of the flavors that you might expect, but people loved, and what we saw right away, they loved to sample the whole menu. Like, I gotta try these flavors. I've never heard of this before. I wanna taste curious. It. And being from Starbucks, that was really scary to me because I thought, oh gosh, the line's taking too long. You know, we always had worked so hard to get the line to move fast, but I quickly learned that that's part of the experience. And even if there were flavors that we didn't sell a lot of, that was okay because it was part of that. Like, oh, I want to try it all. I think the only flavor right at the opening that just was a total bomb, it was like a berries, beans, and barbecue sauce.
I remember that one.
Well, it came back.
Yes.
It came back over the past couple of years in a much better form. Still not the top seller, I'm not going to lie, but the original version was not our best showing.
Got it. Okay, so how important is focus for you? Because I read that when you launched, you also had coffee and espresso and a bakery for the morning and then ice cream for the later part of the day. But at some point in time, you just drop the morning stuff. So what made you make that decision?
Oh, gosh, this is a really great question and one that I've carried around with me as a key learning from the early days of Salt and Straw. Again, operating out of fear, I thought we would sell as many things as we could. And I sure know how to sell coffee. So we'll have an espresso machine. And we'll, if we're going to have baked goods, we have a bakery. So let's just bake our own. We even made our own sauces for the coffee flavorings. I mean, we were way over the top and it was really good and it was working. Like, we were, by anyone's standard, doing really well. But oh my gosh, I mean, we were open from like 5 a.m. until midnight.
Oh no.
And we had to train all these people to be baristas and scoopers and it was so complicated. And I remember this friend of mine decided he was going to open a coffee shop across the street from us. And oh my gosh, it felt like a punch in the stomach. I thought, oh gosh, you know, this isn't going to be good for our coffee business. And I slept on it and I woke up the next morning and decided this is the best thing that could ever happen. Let's close the coffee down, give that business to him, and really double down on the ice cream. Because I just knew in my heart that this wasn't sustainable. It's not fun. It was overly complex. And our business went up.
Interesting.
When we focused on just ice cream. So I think, you know, what I learned quickly that if things are too hard and too complicated, and don't get me wrong, I work really freaking hard. And some things are hard, but if they're too hard, it's probably not the right path.
Got it. Okay. So obviously the first day was bonkers. Did you have a sense of how much you needed to make before a certain time to know if this was a viable business? Because like a great first week or a great first month is wonderful, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's a sustainable business. So at what point were you like, okay, like this is really a thing?
I'm still hoping it's really a thing. I mean, I
feel like that fear never really goes away.
No, I truly, like, I wake up and I hustle every day for what I get. I can't emphasize that enough. We opened in August and by October in Oregon, it's Portland, it's raining every day and you don't see the sun till July. So that's when we really started to be super innovative with our menu and make sure that we were attracting people to come in on a regular basis, which again, I think has served us really well over the years since then. Our costs were so dang low. I mean, Tyler and I weren't paying ourselves. Rent is really inexpensive in Portland, which is why it's such a great place to start a business. Overhead and the risk level is just so much lower than, you know, anywhere else that I've ever done business. So I think that kind of contributes to that entrepreneurial spirit of the city. But we opened our second store the following spring, so not even a year later. And that store was really even more successful than the first. And I think that's probably when I started to think, we've got something here. Like, this is, we've now got two. Although then we had two, and it was not twice as hard. It was like five times as hard. So
talk to me about knowing when it's time to expand. Like, how did that piece of it work?
Well, the second store was just very organic because it was an iconic corner back in the day in Portland that really popped into my head when I thought about this idea of community gathering places. I had sat out on the street corner in front of that, it was a coffee shop, in the early 90s smoking clove cigarettes with Thomas Lauderdale from Pink Martini, and just like that scene, it stuck with me, and I knew this location could really epitomize that idea. And so again, we still didn't have any money, but our friends and family came forth and helped fund it. And next we opened a store in my neighborhood, and then we got a call from this woman in Los Angeles named Joan, who owns Jones on 3rd. Mm-hmm. And of course you take that call.
Yes, Jones is an institution.
And so, you know, here we are thinking, oh gosh, we are barely keeping our lives together. How could we ever sell ice cream in LA? But by the end of the meeting, we just were so in love with them that we decided we could certainly figure that out. And we did. We started making ice cream just for them. And through that process, we started to get to know different artisans and chefs and collaborators in Los Angeles, and got to know the market a little bit more, and realized that, you know, no one was really doing what we were doing. And we just felt such a warm welcome from the food community there that it just seemed like a natural next step to open a store. And so we did.
So Danny Meyer, who is the food phenom behind Gramercy Tavern and Maialino and Shake Shack, is an investor. And you've also taken some private equity money at this point in time. So Kim, I'm curious about what your experience with taking on outside money has been like. Why were you interested in it? And what are the pluses and minuses?
It's a really interesting question, especially as a founder and entrepreneur. You know, everyone told me, don't give up equity, don't take on partners. And here we were operating in LA. We opened a kitchen in LA and had, you know, a lot of overhead. At this point, I was able to qualify for some bank loans. So I had a bunch of debt and I couldn't sleep at night. And so some friends had introduced me to Alan Karp, who owns Karp Riley. And every time I left meetings with him, I felt so energized. He had so many great ideas. I would meet and talk with him every couple of months for years before we really decided we needed to take on money. And so I got to know him really well. We had shared values. And it felt like the right thing to do for me versus taking on more debt. I could sleep, you know, it felt like a more secure situation. And we had flown to New York City to attend Danny Meyer's. He had a hospitality course really early in the company's history. And again, similar to Alan Karp, we had gotten to know him and his organization over the years. On the way out the door, they said, "Now, if you ever need any help, call us." And again, don't say that to me if you don't mean it. Because we called them. We called them all the time for help on negotiating contracts, setting up our logistics program, HR questions. And they would always take the call. They would get their top person in their company on the phone. They would help us work through it. So then when they started, looking to put together an investment portfolio, we had known each other for so long and worked together that it just made sense that they would, you know, sign on and we would kind of be part of the family. So for me, it was, again, very organic and something that came together over a number of years. And it were relationships that brought something new to the business that were really valuable. So I feel really lucky from that perspective.
Very much so. So let's talk about challenges, because especially as entrepreneurs, I think that we have this sense that we have to present this like everything is perfect, this Instagram filtered life and career. And that's not how it is. So I'm hoping you can tell me a little bit about a big challenge or a difficult moment that you've experienced through running Salt and Straw and what you've learned from it.
Gosh, it's very poignant to talk about challenges at this moment in time as we're just kind of coming through, I guess, what I would call the first chapter of our pandemic experience.
Right.
All my other challenges, I think, pale in comparison to what we've been through the past 6 months or so. When the pandemic hit, we had to close all of our stores. It was amazing because it had taken about 10 years to build the company in about 10 minutes to close them all down and lay everyone off. And I'm sorry, it's very emotional, but it was awful and it was unbelievable. I could not believe that we were going through that experience, you know, having taken so many careful steps to be sure that we were always in a safe position.
Yeah.
And we were always doing the right thing for our team and, you know, giving up equity, whatever we needed to do to make sure the company was always safe and thriving, and to see that all crumble in a matter of, you know, days, minutes, weeks was unbelievable. And I think, you know, as we've gone through that experience, I just hung up the phone right before I got to talk to you with our team, talking about how we go back out to everyone in our company now. We've rehired 500 people and we're growing again, and things are we're on a really good trajectory at this point, which I do not take for granted, and I'm so grateful for it. But we just got off the phone talking about how we double down and invest in our values and communicating those to our team, making sure we have decision-making, you know, abilities around staying close to those and everything that we do. And I think as we go forward, rebuilding that trust with our team, with our communities, with our customers, I just feel like that's so much of what we have to do as a society in this next chapter that we're going through, both from a political and from a business perspective.
So a lot of the people who listen to this podcast are in their first lives. And I think especially going through this pandemic has really given people a moment to think about, what do I really want to do and how do I really want to spend my time? And you know, for a lot of people, making a career move right now is not the opportunity. It's not the option. But for some people, it also has sort of crystallized, okay, I need to start moving forward with the next thing that I want to do. So if someone is interested in switching lanes or making that leap or doing something for themselves, what advice would you give them?
Well, one of my favorite things to say when I'm asked to give advice is that I really have maintain this mantra to not take advice. Because if I had taken most of the advice when I was trying to get my company started, I wouldn't be here today. I mean, I had most people telling me that this was the worst thing I could ever think of on so many levels, to start your own business, to start an ice cream store.
In a recession. Cash in your 401k to sell your house. I'm not going to like him. These are not moves that I generally, I think people recommend. But man, has it worked out for you?
I mean, sure, maybe that all sounds foolish in hindsight, but I honestly think, like, really staying true to your vision and what you know deep down in your heart is right. And you know, and you do know when you're not totally sure, or you have some more things to work out, or, but you know when you know. And I think listening to that and believing in that is probably, as cheesy as it sounds, it's the advice I would give. And then on the flip side, you know, I did say I had a damn good business plan, and I still refer to it to this day. We'll dust it off and look at it and update different pieces of it. And so I think there's this belief in yourself, and there's also a lot of very serious, diligent planning that goes into it.
And the other part of it too is that you had a really successful first life in which you were learning all kinds of amazing skills that you knew in your heart of hearts that you could take forward and apply to different businesses and different opportunities.
Well, I think that's so true. And especially when I talk to like college age students and they want to go out and start their own business right away, which I think is great. You should do that if you want to do that. But I oftentimes say, like, don't be discouraged if you're spending, you know, 10, 15, 20, whatever the time frame is, in other jobs and doing other things, because you're collecting experience and you're getting ready. And so I think that's really important.
Do you still use skills from your first life in your day-to-day at Salt and Straw?
So many skills.
Kim, tell me.
Oh, I mean, it's everything from like the basics around financial analysis to the human relations and how I learned to, you know, work as a team, how to write a brand vision, how to conduct market research. I could go on and on. How to do a market tour and select real estate. It just, it was so, so valuable. I always say I learned enough to be dangerous, you know, because when you walk into your own business with what you think is a vast, you know, years of experience, I don't think you can ever appreciate, you know, what all those other departments were actually doing behind the scenes. And when it's all on you, it's like, ah, this is a lot harder than they made it look. But, I know enough to be dangerous. That's what I took with me.
I love that. Okay, so Kim, my last question is my favorite question, which is, if you could go back in time and speak with your younger self and give yourself some business advice, what would you say? Other than don't take advice.
So this might sound funny after all the times I repeated this during this conversation, but I think I would put a hand on each shoulder and say not to be so afraid and to enjoy it a little bit more, to invest where you know in your heart you need to invest and take those chances so you're not holding on too tight. But more than anything, just enjoy it a little bit more and appreciate the successes that you have along the way.
It's so interesting to hear you talk about being afraid when I also look at your career from the outside and see risk after risk after risk and brave move after brave move after brave move. It's interesting that the internal story has, you know, this other side to it.
Yeah, I guess maybe that's the yin and yang, kind of the balance to that. Yeah. I think the secret is finding that balance where the fear is motivating you and driving you and fueling you and not making you frozen and unable to move. It's a fine balance.
Or unable to sleep.
Yeah. Sleep is important. I am a true believer in that.
Well, Kim, as one earth sign to another, thank you so much for your time. I'm so touched by your honesty. I love your career story. Thank you for walking me through it. I know our audience is going to really, really love it. I know I do personally.
Oh, well, thank you so much. It means the world to me.
That was the president and CEO of Salt and Straw, Kim Malik. For more inspiring interviews with women like Kim, head on over to secondlifepod.com, where we have so many more for you to peruse. If you like today's show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to rate and review us. We love seeing you spread the word on social, and now you can tag us in your posts. We are at Second Life Pod on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We always want to know who you'd like to hear from on the show, so send us your ideas to hello@secondlifepod.com, or you can just DM us on Instagram. I'm at Hillary Kerr, the show's at Second Life Pod. Our DMs are always open. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Second Life.